This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 249 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I have two co-hosts to introduce. First, we have David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi, Max. Actually, it should be the What Just Flew In. I just got in about 10 minutes ago from a long day at the office. I'm making a guest appearance, but I don't think I'm going to be able to make it through the whole episode, folks.
Okay, well, we'll enjoy the benefit of your wisdom and knowledge for as long as it lasts. And then we'll talk with Rob Mark, our other co-host. He's our pilot, and he's from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, good evening, and welcome to beautiful, well, yeah, I can't really welcome you to Chicago, but if you were here, I would say welcome where it's 83 degrees. And I just want to let people know that I'm changing the strategy on Jetwind. It used to be aviation buzz and bold opinion, and now it's going to be complete and utter whining about the cost of college for freshmen. So I just wanted to let anybody know about
that. All right. Yeah, the joys of fatherhood. Good luck with that.
In fact, I now have an oxygen tank right here close to my desk, just in case the breathing gets a little, you know, over the top.
Good. You might need it.
That was probably due to your age, Rob. It wasn't due to the fact that your daughter's now in college.
Oh.
Maybe the combination.
That. Oh. Okay.
Well, I can tell you who won't be disappointing, and that's our guest this episode. It's Jason Parr. Now, Jason's a returning guest. He's an instrument-rated pilot, and he's a journalist and writer who covers aerospace at Wired and Medium. Jason, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, thanks for having me back, guys. It's been a long time, but it's nice to be here again. And I will say hello. Not quite 83 degrees, but it's a balmy, I guess it's only 67 degrees in sunny Seattle.
And it really is actually sunny?
I kid you not. I had to close the blinds on my window because the glare off the screen was too much.
Have you been watching hundreds of 787s fly around the traffic pattern?
There's definitely more of them. There was a spate there where we didn't have any flying overhead, and I have seen a handful of them lately, and I guess it's a refreshing thing to see them back flying. It's been interesting going up to Payne Field and seeing what is effectively a giant 787 parking lot, because there is pretty much every piece of reinforced concrete has a 787 sitting on top of it up there right now.
Yeah, I'm sure Boeing is very eager to move that inventory off the lot.
Yeah, I think they just want to reduce their parking fees.
That's right. Yeah, they're probably adding up to quite a lot. Now, Jason, we all know what Wired.com is, but you're also writing for something called Medium. Is that right? What is that?
Well, Medium is a relatively new thing that started up. It was started by the same guys that founded Twitter, who are also the same guys that founded Blogger back in the olden days. And they wanted to try to find a new type of writing outlet. And so what they've done with Medium is focused a place where the main focus is on high-quality writing and less sort of snippets and less, I guess, less, you know, negativity and less kind of harping on things. They want to just try to get people to write about things they know, get people to write about things they enjoy. And it's definitely a work in progress. There's a lot of different posts up there on Medium right now. And they're trying to start different collections. And these collections are basically, you know, you start a topic, you write about something you know about or that you like, and you invite other people to write about it as well. And the goal is to try to get communities to write collaboratively about these different things and you know, create some good content. And I've been posed with a challenge to start writing about aerospace with Medium. And so, matter of fact, just today, just a few hours ago, we launched what is being called the Lift and Drag Collection. And of course, we all know Lift and Drag for its beauty and, well, what do you call drag? Lack of beauty? But it's going to be a new collection on Medium that is going to just, you know, hopefully get some, we're encouraging more people to write for Medium and Lift and Drag and, you know, to join the community. And in my introduction story, I kind of played off the whole Lift and Drag idea because nowadays it seems that there are some of us see everything about aviation as a lift. And there, of course, are the perhaps more average airline passengers who see most things about aviation as a drag. So we're trying to encourage a little bit of everything, you know, people who are total geeks and want to write about the nerdiest of details and people who just got off a business flight and want to, you know, moan about the peanuts or something.
Yeah, fascinating.
Wait a minute. I thought you said there wasn't going to be a lot of whining on the Medium. I mean, because I assumed that that comment was directed specifically.
Oh, ouch. Oh, sorry. No, my bad.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, I've made quite a name for myself complaining about just about everything. And now you want me to change?
Jason didn't say wine, but it was close. It was close.
Oh, okay. Actually, no, I want to second Jason's comments about the Lift and Drag, because it's a really well-written piece. It's a very well-written piece, and I would encourage everybody to go up and take a look.
Now, Jason, where do we find Lift and Drag?
You can go to medium.com/lift-and-drag. And right now, the introduction post that's up there right now is indeed just that, an introduction. Like I said, Medium is really trying to encourage more and more people to contribute. And you'll see that if you explore Medium a little bit, there are different collections out there. Some of them have dozens. A few of them have hundreds of entries on them where people have written in on a more or less central theme. So far, it's been a little bit tech-centric, which I guess makes sense when you have the founders of Twitter and a San Francisco-based company.
Sure.
But again, the horizons are expanding, and today we launched the aerospace section. And so for people who are interested in contributing and writing on Medium, they can contact me through the website or on email, and I guess we can put links up on your website.
Yeah, for sure. We'll put the links in there that in the show notes so people can click right to it. So that's great. Sounds fascinating. I'm really excited about the prospects for that.
Yeah, it's really intriguing. It's definitely a work in progress. We'll have to see how it fleshes itself out.
Sure. Well, the aviation community, as you know very well, Jason, is a pretty passionate bunch of people. And you give passionate people a forum to get behind, and they'll do it. So I think the future on that looks pretty good.
That's the hope. And we can spread the geekdom beyond our own borders. That's part of the goal, too, is to have people stumble upon the Lift and Drag and be intrigued by what they see, and otherwise be going to some of the great blogs like Jetwine.
You know, I like that concept of spreading the geekdom. That sounds like something Dan Webb would have said.
It does, doesn't it?
But I like that.
Yeah, that's very good.
And thank you for that nice compliment, Jason. That's why I'm wired, man.
Oh, here we go.
Okay.
Enough. Let's move on.
All right, yeah, let's get back to work.
Time to move ahead. That's right. We're going to talk with Jason about the Solar Impulse. Many of our listeners, I think, may have seen Jason's articles in Wired.com and in other places about the Solar Impulse, and he's got some good insights onto what's going on with that. So we'll be talking about that coming up. We've also got some interesting aviation news. We'll try to blast through pretty quickly so we have more time with Jason. And let's see, what else have we got? We've got David, no history segment this time because David's got to bail out, which is fine. We'll catch up with that next time. We have the Australia Desk Report with Stephen Grant and Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment as well. So all that coming up. But first, let's get started with some aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Yeah. Ready.
Ready to go.
Our first story comes from Business Insider. This is, you can bid on Air Force One for as little as $50,000. Well, this Air Force One is a McDonnell Douglas DC-9, actually a DC-9-32 that the GSA is selling. That's the General Services Administration. And this is a plane that they say is a plane that flew Presidents Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, as well as the Vice President, the First Lady, Cabinet Secretaries, four-star generals, admirals, foreign dignitaries, and more. Now, this is an auction that started on May 15th. And I think, I mean, David, with a history as checkered as this one, I really can't see them having any difficulty auctioning off this airplane. What do you think?
No, I don't know. I mean, what do overused DC-9s go for on the market? Yes, it occasionally had the call sign of Air Force One, and I kind of was, yeah, that's a little more publicity than DC-9. The C-9s were used for VIPs, but primarily they were used for things like senators and congressmen. And yeah, there may have been a presidential ride occasionally, unlike our current president, who hops on the 747 to come up to Philadelphia. Back in the day, we did have other presidents who were more conservative. Yeah, I mean, it's a DC-9 by any other name is a DC-9. Yes, it has an executive interior in it, but it's still a well-used DC-9. And actually, its sister is at the Air Force Museum now.
Oh, is that
to
right?
Be put on display.
In Dayton.
So, yes, it's in very pretty colors, designed by Jacqueline Onassis, but a DC-9 still is a DC-9.
Well, we'll put a link in the show notes to the GSA site where, if you like, you can submit your bid. I think the starting bid is $50,000, which is, I mean, that's not really all that much, but it'll be fun to see where it goes.
Yeah, but melting it down, you'd probably get that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you probably would.
I mean, they're melting down airplanes a lot newer than that.
Well, and let's face it, Delta probably will buy it for parts.
If you want it, you have until May 30th to get your bid in, so don't delay.
And note, the article does say, quote, may have acted as Air Force One.
That's right.
So there is really no documented proof that it actually flew a president.
All right. Well, anything to reduce the budget. You know, maybe this will fund one or two more controllers.
Oh, you mean it'll fund approximately a half hour worth of F-22 time?
Yeah, just about. All right. Sticking with the military theme, our second story comes from the New York Daily News. This is U.S. military makes history by launching a new type of jet-powered drone from an aircraft carrier. This is the X-47B. Which has taken off from the aircraft carrier, the George H.W. Bush. And this article says it's the first time a drone has been launched at sea. Now, the X-47B, that's the Unmanned Combat Air System Demonstrator, or UCAS-D. And this was a catapult launch from the aircraft carrier. And I guess it made a few low approaches around the carrier, and then took off and landed at Naval Air Station Patuxent River in Maryland after a flight of about an hour. So, I mean, to me, this seems like a pretty important milestone.
Well, for all of us drone lovers, and I keep finding out that I'm a drone hater on Twitter. I haven't quite figured that out yet, but I have all of these followers who are anti-drone people. The X-47B completed one of the three hardest challenges, which was the catapult launch. But in the scheme of things, that's one of the easiest things to do. The harder part, and if you watch the video put out by the Navy, is you get to watch the one gentleman walk around with a box with a joystick. And when I did my interview at Pax River about the Northrop guys about the X-47B, and I forget what episode that is, but we'll put it in the show notes. They said the hardest challenge would be moving the aircraft on the deck.
Yeah,
and that was also part of the challenge of this catapult launch. Was they did have other aircraft on the deck, and they were maneuvering the X-47B to the catapult. So that probably was caused more angst than the actual, once it was on the catapult, it going down and flying. Now, the first day they did a couple of passes. We're recording this on the 20th. And believe it or not, they actually flew it lower and lower. And we actually did a touch and go off the Herbert Walker Bush today. They actually landed rubber on it.
Oh, wow.
So that's the next step, is to be able to go around, and the following step will be then to lower the hook, which has caused all sorts of angst, like the F-35. For some reason, the Navy's been having trouble designing tail hooks. Not that I'm an expert. I only own one.
so far.
But, what a scandal.
The next step, and that'll probably be after another couple of days of touch and goes and getting flying the pattern and stuff, will be an arrested landing. So earlier this year, we were talking about how wonderful it was for the Chinese to launch manned aircraft on and off an aircraft carrier, and what an accomplishment it was for them. Here we are doing it where the guy is sitting in Patuxent River 400 or 500 miles away doing touch and goes. So take that, the rest of the world. We are the best at what we do. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say that?
Now, isn't the end game here that instead of having to rely on, you know, other countries to establish bases for drones, that we can put them on a boat and send the boat wherever we want, and we can launch our drones whenever and wherever we want? Isn't that the kind of the end game?
This is actually it. The aircraft has two bomb bays, can carry the same. Carry small diameter bombs or 2,000 pound laser guided bombs. And yes, instead of putting our pilots and F-18s in harm's way, we can launch drones and attack higher value targets, meaning you want to attack things like anti-aircraft batteries or anti-aircraft missiles, surface-air missiles, or high value targets, so that the rest of the manned aircraft can go get in safer and do the cleanup. So the other small event that this is going to take place is when it's capable of air-to-air refueling, and that will be the ultimate challenge.
For sure.
When a X-47B pops out its refueling probe and it refuels into a drogued aircraft like an F-18 Super Hornet or a C-130. So besides that, that would give them indefinite range.
Now, David, I'm sure...
I think that range...
Go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say, I think that range is definitely one of the things they talk about, too, with the X-47. Because you don't have a person on board, it's already able to go, well, in theory, it's able to go further, so that the carrier, you know, can launch an aircraft from much further away than they can launch F-18s. And, you know, these things can fly much greater distances, which gives the footprint of the, or increases the footprint of the carrier quite a long ways. And I know that when I remember years ago seeing some of these first unmanned combat air system vehicles down at Edwards. And, you know, even back then, this is maybe a decade ago, they were talking about the ability to not only hit targets perhaps that are hotter, but, you know, that fleets of these things can fly in autonomously. And, you know, if one's damaged, it can be pre-programmed to hit a target on its own, basically turning itself into from a bomber into a missile. And so there's, you know, obviously all sorts of different imaginative ways that these things can be used. And I've got a second what David was saying, you know, I was watching some of the touch and goes they were doing on Friday, and it's eerie seeing, you know, one of these autonomous vehicles. And again, they're not being piloted by somebody sitting at a control stick. They're pre-programmed to do this. And it's interesting. Although I have to say, I also was wondering with a friend what their beach volleyball skills were like, because it's pretty hard to beat Val Kilmer and Tom Cruise when it comes to beach volleyball.
Oh, I guess so.
Yeah, they're not going to be, well, I don't know. We could always say that their R2-D2 is now moved into the came forward from the 70s into the 21st century. You know, when we start naming the aircraft, I mean, the UCAS is, if we're going to quote movies, is far better than stealth and whatever that abomination of a movie was.
So when do you use a completely autonomous drone, and when do you use one that is remotely piloted? I'm not sure if I understand.
That's a good question.
Well, the answer is a completely autonomous aircraft is it's programmed to fly a set course. For example, we do have autonomous air vehicles now. They're called cruise missiles. They are programmed to fly by themselves, to make decisions by themselves, and to attack their target. Now, where you want somebody in a cockpit or in a box somewhere is when you are doing a mission like a Reaper or a Predator, where you need to have a set of eyes on the target before you fire. Yes, you'd like the autonomous vehicles to do their programming, but sometimes you want that, you know, nothing's better than the Mark One eyeball to make a determination, you know, and that's why we will never lose pilots. It's going to be, there are going to have to be decisions made, and a UCAS like this, you would program to attack a hardened shelter, but you know you're going to attack it. Whereas something like a Reaper or a Predator, where you're taking out a terrorist, or you might need a pair of eyes. You don't want it making the decision. You want to make the decision. Does that answer the question, Rob?
Yeah, it does. Okay, good question.
It's also an evolving thing, too, I think, where the first step was with the Predators, where there's a pilot and somebody manning the camera, and usually a team of people behind them that are the intelligence types. But I think it's a constantly evolving thing, too, where with some of these autonomous vehicles, yes, they can be pre-programmed to strike a known target, but they can also be programmed to make decisions going in. And I know I've talked to a few people in the Air Force and Navy who have said, one of the ideas is that the vehicle would have the ability to see something and act upon it, and you can determine the level of human interaction. And so one is, yes, a pilot still might be sitting at a console, but instead of one pilot controlling one Predator, you might have one pilot controlling, say, 10 of these UCAS vehicles. And when one has a question, it can fire off the question back to that person monitoring the whole system. And that person can make a click of the mouse and say, yes, no, maybe. And so you do have the ability to sort of increase, instead of one person flying one aircraft, you can have one person flying 10 or more aircraft.
Wow. It's never going to be the same, is it?
And then just wait till we start putting them on airliners.
What a great lead-in, because we also have an article from, this is from the Daily Mail. This is, "Welcome to Drone Air. First passenger plane piloted remotely flies across the UK in pioneering trial." Now, this was a British Aerospace Jetstream 31, which is, what, Rob, you must be really familiar with these. These are, twin turboprop.
Just say noisy.
They're noisy?
They're very noisy, yeah. They had very high RPM motors on them on the ground, and you would go deaf if you were close to one of these when they were taxiing by. And they were cramped, and they weren't real comfortable, but they sold a bunch of them, and they ran the dickens out of them for 20 years.
Wow.
Didn't you say that last week about the DO 328?
Yeah. Except that the 31 was pressurized. That's the only advantage that it had over the dork.
Oh, okay.
So
the dork. The dork?
Oh, yeah. That's what we used to call them. We used to call them dorks.
Oh, dear. All right. Well, this this particular aircraft, what they did is they put cameras in the cockpit and also underneath the plane that would send high def images back to operators on the ground. And then they also transmitted information about the aircraft and what was going on around it, according to the article, saying that this gave the operators exactly the same data that they would have if they were in the cockpit. And they flew this thing for 500 miles. And I think this was through the commercial airspace.
Yeah, I think that was the big thing, was flying it through the commercial airspace.
Yeah.
That was their big accomplishment.
Yeah, big deal. But they also had two guys in the front seats. There were two pilots there just in case.
Oh, did they have some backup?
Really, yeah, it wasn't really. Well. So, I mean, it was being flown without them touching it, apparently, but they were there just in case.
Well, wouldn't you want it that way, Rob?
Well, yeah, actually, I would. In fact, I'd like to just see, call me crazy. I'd like to see pilots up there all the time.
Yeah, well, certainly for the in the test phase, but this is, I mean, we're really going in this direction. Now, they have a lot of other tests that they want to run. They want to make sure this thing is safe and introduce.
All right, wait a minute.
What?
Okay, quick poll. Max,
yes.
Would you get on an airplane today that was certified by the FAA as safe to fly with no pilot aboard whatsoever? Would you do that?
If you say today or right now, my answer would be no.
I'm sure something will change in the next 5 or 10 years, but...
Well, if you ask me in 20 years, if either of us are still alive, I would probably then say yes, along with probably a lot of other people who are saying
yes. David, how about you? Are you open-minded? I hear a little hesitation.
More than a little.
I'll be honest. I don't think the technology is there yet. But like Max, talk to me in about 5 years. I think we're getting close, and this is a big step. I understand that there were two dummies sitting in the front seat, but they didn't do anything on the whole flight. I mean, you might as well put crash test dummies in a car. This was flown as an unmanned aircraft, you know, and I'm not talking about two women pilots. they were there, and I don't blame them for them being there, but we're getting close, and yeah, I think, Rob, you're right. You're never going to see pilotless airliners, but we have talked about single pilot operations, and, you know, if you talk to a 727 pilot 20 years ago, their flight engineer said that they would have a job forever. Then the flight engineer got eliminated, and so now we're down to two pilots, and clearly, if you're Air India, you just need flight attendants to fly the aircraft. So I can see real quickly that we can go to one pilot, single pilot operations.
I see the marketing scheme on that way. We didn't get a chance to hear from Jason. What do you think, Jason? Would you jump on?
I guess I'll be the person who will buck the trend and say that I think, one, you'll see pilotless airliners, and I think you'll see them not so far out in the future. You know, the technology is already there in many ways. I'm sure many of us, whether we knew it or not, have been on a almost pilotless flight already. I'm sure Rob knows all about autoland capabilities and Cat 3 approaches where the pilots feel the runway before they see it, and software is making the landing the whole way. I've been on a demonstration flight flying through the canyons of the Columbia River below ridgetops in an airliner. And, you know, the airplane made all the turns and did everything all autonomously. And, you know, that was some fairly challenging flying. So I think the biggest challenge, as you guys hinted at it, is going to be the marketing. People are going to be uncomfortable. But I've also, you know, I've had these discussions with other friends, and people have brought up the fact that in the early part of the 1900s, when the gentleman standing there in the elevator started to disappear, people thought that was craziness. How could you get rid of the elevator operator? What happens when the elevator starts plummeting to the floor? You know, what's going to stop us? Who's going to save us? But lo and behold, we're perfectly okay with autonomous elevators nowadays. And people are getting more comfortable with autonomous cars. And in that case, I think a lot of people are probably happy to get rid of the texting, eating, shaving, yakking people that are driving next to them. Yeah. And so while pilots are a little bit different and, you know, and that they're hopefully better trained and paying attention most of the time, I can see them, see it happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And the one caveat I would add is that if in this process, in this transformation, there is an accident that's attributed to a failure of the, of the system, then I think you've got to add 20 years to, you know, the acceptance of that. It would just set it back, I think, 20 years.
That's a hell of a big but.
Well, yeah.
But it's also interesting when you look at the fact that we, there's been a few recent highly publicized aviation accidents where it was pretty clearly that it was pilot error. And so, you inserted a flesh and bone autopilot that unfortunately made a mistake or two that led to an accident. But that doesn't set anything back. So it is interesting. I agree with you that it probably would be the case, but it would also be an interesting argument to say, well, you know, the accidents are happening with people as well. So
drones and autopilots don't get tired or sleep deprived.
Okay, again, our guest is Jason Parr from Wired and other places recently, which we mentioned at the start of the show. But Jason, you have been publishing a number of articles about the solar impulse, which are it's just a fascinating concept, I think. But maybe we can start off just for a minute describing the aircraft itself and what it's intended to accomplish for any of our listeners who may not be aware.
Sure. It's funny. I've kind of struggled with how do you describe the solar impulse. And I think the easiest place to start is sort of like an oversized glider. It's, you know, I've used things like the, you know, it's a kind of a gentle giant. It's sort of an albatross. Because I think the interesting thing is it has a wingspan of around 200 feet. So, you know, in the ballpark of a 747 wingspan. But it weighs, you know, about the same as a small twin, basically. I think its gross weight is 3,500 pounds or something like that.
Yes.
So you have quite a bit of wing and not a whole lot of airplane suspended underneath it. It's got four engines on it, four motors, electric motors. They're each rated to about 10 horsepower. So you can tell it's not an aircraft designed to get anywhere in a big hurry. But those four electric motors are powered exclusively by the sun. And there's the entire 200 or so foot wingspan is covered by about, I think, just over 11,000 solar cells, as well as the horizontal stabilizer. And those solar cells can get going as soon as the sun pops above the horizon and get the electric motors spinning. And the aircraft can then climb and fly by solar power. And not only fly by solar power, but charge onboard batteries, which means when the sun goes down at the end of the day, the airplane can actually continue flying through the night. And they've actually done a full 26-hour flight cycle with one of these already.
Now, this comes from some Swiss folk, doesn't it? At least one of the co-founders is Swiss.
Yep, they're both Swiss. Bertrand Piccard is a somewhat famous person in the aerospace world. He, I think it was in the late 90s, he made the first nonstop circumnavigation of the world in a balloon. Or I guess balloon's not the proper term. I always get, you know, people always, the balloon community always tells you that it's not a balloon. What are they, oh boy, now I'm drawing a blank for what the proper term is. Anyways.
Yes. Grant will tell us.
In a gas-filled device. And then, and he's been a pilot for a long time. His father was a famous explorer who explored the deep ocean trenches. So he's got a family history of some interesting adventurers. And then he, along with a gentleman named André Borschberg, who's a former Swiss Air Force pilot and pilot of many different types of aircraft, co-founded the Solar Impulse Project. And their end goal is to fly a solar-powered aircraft around the world. And they've made a handful of flights in Europe. They made one short flight down to North Africa. And right now, they are sitting in Phoenix on the getting ready to start the second leg of their Across America flight, which is going to take them from San Francisco to Phoenix to Dallas to St. Louis to Washington, D.C., and finally up to New York.
Now, Jason, you've talked with these folks directly.
I did. I went down to the hangar down at Moffett Field where they were staging the aircraft and got a chance to look the airplane over and look in the cockpit and talk with both the pilots, the co-pilots, who are also the only pilots for the aircraft. And definitely fascinating. You know, a lot of stuff had been written sort of about the idea of solar-powered aircraft and renewable energy and all that sort of thing. And by all means, I've written a few stories along those lines myself. But being able to see the airplane in person, the pilot geek in me really just wanted to know, what was it like to fly? You know, how does it fly? Is there anything unusual? And there's a whole lot of interesting little tidbits about that airplane, starting with the fact that it's a tail dragger with only one main gear. So,
It's kind of like a U-2 in that regard.
Yeah, it is similar to a U-2 in that it has one main belly wheel. And, you know, also that the wings are sort of out there on their own. And the pilots actually, you know, they both commented that it is similar in that regard. Unlike the U-2, this airplane is staged on the runway, so it's towed out. It's an extremely delicate airplane. So they try to minimize any risk for damaging it. Much of the airplane is just foam covered in a thin sheet of a Mylar type of material. As a matter of fact, when I was visiting, there was another guest visitor, and while we were looking in the cockpit, and Andre and Bertrand were showing me the controls, they looked over, and this gentleman had his hand wrapped in a fist, and you could tell he was just about to knock on the fuselage, as if you're knocking on a door, or like you're knocking on any airplane to, you know, see what it feels like.
Yeah.
Oh, and the screaming and the stop, because they then explained that it's just soft foam, and if you were to do that, you would actually just put a giant ding in the airplane. So it's extremely delicate.
I think I read in one of your pieces that the takeoff speed and landing speed is actually greater than the cruise speed. Is that right?
Yeah, that was one of the interesting things, you know, trying to, I sort of wanted to put my own little, flight manual for it together, at least in my head, and wanted to know, you know, okay, if I had to fly it, what do you take off? What's the cruise and all that stuff, all that kind of thing. And it turns out to get off the ground, they push the power levers all the way forward and rotate. Actually, I shouldn't say rotate. One of the things they clarified, there is really no rotation. It just levitates off the ground once about 29 miles an hour is reached. And that's so you're taking off at 29 miles an hour. And then once you get to the point when you're airborne, you slow it down to about 26 miles an hour, which is their cruise speed. When it comes time to land, you push the power levers forward again, and you accelerate to 29 miles an hour and fly it right down to the ground.
So it must be pretty wind limited then, I would imagine, huh?
Yeah, it is wind limited. They, I'm trying to remember the numbers. See, if I was smart, I would have had these right off the top of my head. I think it was 10 miles an hour is their max wind, and 5 was the cross component, so there wasn't a whole lot of wind available. It does have its single main wheel that is the main landing gear on the belly actually is a castering wheel, so they can land and take off and theoretically in a crosswind. Now they said that they just wouldn't bother taking off if there was any kind of a crosswind; they would just wait. But they've already had to use the castering main gear in a landing, so the airplane can crab into the wind just like all pilots do. But instead of having to, you know, kick that rudder pedal and straighten out the airplane just as you touch down, they can just land in that crab, and that main gear will continue straight ahead while the airplane is actually pointed into the wind.
Jason, one thing that I was kind of wondering about is, and I don't know if you can comment on this or not, but I'm wondering how much of this is sort of a technology demonstration. And when I say this, I mean, let's say this flight across the United States or in the future a flight around the world. How much of it is a demonstration of the technology, and how much of it is just the thrill, the challenge to be the first to do it?
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting question. It's definitely raised quite a bit, and I raise it with them, and you could tell that by their response that it's a question they get quite often. And, you know, ever since the stories came out on Wired, we've had a lot of comments and a lot of people emailing me that, you know, ask, so, you know, what the heck, why are they even bothering? It flies at 26 miles an hour, that's hardly useful. And I think, indeed, the answer is that it's largely a technological challenge. It's a challenge to overcome. As a demonstrator, it is, you can make the argument that, you know, solar airplanes have been around for a while. And matter of fact, you know, the first solar airplane that crossed America did it 20 years ago or so. Eric Raymond flew his Sunseeker across the country. So it's not even really a new thing, at least flying across the U.S. Hmm. I think Bertrand Piccard is being the first guy to fly the gas field balloon-like device around the world.
Yeah.
I think he is intrigued about sort of that idea of being the first, but they're both very passionate about talking about alternative, forms of energy and alternative forms of transportation or of powering transportation. So that's something that they're both very big on. And I think anytime somebody says, oh yes, the airplane only cruises at, you know, whatever, 30 miles an hour or less, the Wright brothers didn't fly that fast when they got started.
Yeah, sure. Exactly.
And, It's hard to say where the imagination is going to take us in the next 100 years. I think it's they're the first to say they're not trying to promote the idea that we're going to have electric airliners anytime soon, if ever. But perhaps we'll find other uses for it. The idea is already being thrown about quite realistically that this could be a low orbiting satellite. You could have a communications antenna at 60,000 feet over a city that could, fly 24/7 without a pilot, purely on solar power.
Yeah, and I don't want anybody to, misunderstand that I'm not being judgmental or anything, with my question. In fact, just the opposite. I mean, I believe pretty strongly that, developing technology, doing research purely for the, the purpose of advancing the research is worthwhile. And you don't know where it's going to lead. Sometimes it leads nowhere, but a lot of times it leads to unintended great things. So I think that's fantastic.
And that, of course, is one of the issues that everybody's upset about with the budget problems that we have in the U.S. is how much of the research funds are not going to be there to places like, NASA and others and MIT that used to just go out and try this kind of thing. So that's a concern as well. Jason, I'm curious, do you know if the pilots had parachutes?
Yeah, they do. They both wear parachutes during the flight. They mentioned the fact that flying the airplane, it's got all pushrod controls. It has a standard yoke in the cockpit. I move the yoke back and forth, and it's honestly a fingertip aircraft. You can move it, and it has 8 ailerons on that 200-foot wingspan, and you can move all of the ailerons with just the lightest of a touch. But they said when it gets to be turbulent, the airplane is a true handful. And the way they described it, it sounded like it doesn't have the best inherent stability, and it's constantly yawing and slipping. And Bertrand mentioned that the yarn string, they use a string on the cockpit window like sailplane pilots do. And they said, that yarn string is constantly sliding back and forth. In describing some of this more turbulent air and, the large amount of pilot inputs that are required to keep the airplane flying straight and level, they also mentioned the fact that they do wear parachutes. And the airplane wasn't flight tested to the extremes in the sense that it was never stalled. They had a test pilot that did some of the initial flights, and they put the usual little tufts of yarn on the top of the wing. But instead of stalling it, the pilot brought it back towards a stall, and the two co-founders were flying behind in a helicopter, and they could see as the air started to detach from the upper surface of the wing that it detached uniformly and symmetrically, and that was enough. So they didn't bother to go to the full stall, nor have they done, obviously haven't done spin testing, of course, but they haven't done even very steep turns. They try to limit all of their turns to just 5 degrees of bank angle. And to the point to where one of the interesting things in the cockpit, on either side, they have a Dynan, multifunction display there in the cockpit. But on either side of that artificial horizon, there are 5 lights, and those lights are wired in, and it's 1 degree per light. So if you're banking 1 degree to the right, one light on the right side will be lit up. And of course, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 2 lights, 3 lights. And as an airline pilot, I'm sure aircraft that have stick shakers as you approach the stall, Solar Impulse also has a stick shaker, but interestingly, it's tied to the bank angle. So it goes, 1 degree through 5 degrees. And once you exceed 5 degrees of bank, the stick shaker starts and it alerts the pilot that you're beginning to exceed 5 degrees of bank. So they're very cautious and careful about keeping this airplane in a fairly small flight envelope.
Interesting. Now, the project has its own website. It's solarimpulse.com. And Jason, we'll put links to all of the articles that you've written for Wired in the show notes as well. They started the cross-country flight in San Francisco, and as we record this, they've made it to Phoenix. And I guess the next stop is Texas, right? Is it Dallas? Is that where they're headed to next?
That's right, yeah. The next stop is Dallas. That first flag was flown from a historic Moffett Field where they were keeping the airplane in one of those giant dirigible hangars. Bertrand Piccard flew the first leg to Phoenix. I think it was about an 18-hour flight. They landed just after midnight in Phoenix local time. And they've been there now, I guess, going on a couple weeks. And Andre will fly the next leg to Dallas. They're keeping a watchful eye on weather, of course, because they want to avoid things like the giant string of thunderstorms and tornadoes currently moving through the Midwest.
Oh, for sure.
And yeah, and then after Dallas, they're going to head up to St. Louis.
And then from there, do they go to Washington, to D.C.?
Yep, east from St. Louis, up and over the Appalachians, and then down into D.C. And then the final leg will be to JFK in New York. So it's going to be mixing it up with all the big iron.
And who funded this whole program again?
They have a variety of sponsors. It's quite an impressive lineup of fundraising, I have to say, that the whole project is, I can't even imagine. I've seen numbers thrown out north of $100 million for what the entire project will entail. And so they have a wide range of sponsors, including several Swiss companies and other international companies, some that are, related technologies, and others that are sponsoring purely for the ability or the opportunity to sponsor.
That's great. And I think you can even donate money yourself at their webpage.
That's right. Yeah, I think there's all sorts of things for people who are interested in the flight. There's definitely a lot on their website. They have a pretty good communications program going. They're very active on Twitter, and they actually will even they'll be doing some live interviews from the flight. We're setting up to do a live interview on one of the legs we'll be able to do via satellite, do a live video interview. And we're actually going to try to get some of our readers at Wired to suggest some questions and to participate in the interview.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. Very exciting. All right. I want to ask you about your trip to Wichita, Jason. Saw some interesting things in Wichita, did you?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've been an aviation geek as long as I can remember, and I've been a pilot for more than 10 years now and been covering aviation for more than a decade, and I'd never been to Wichita. It's, perhaps it was sort of a Seattle snooty thing where I always figure where the big airplane maker is, so I didn't need to go to Wichita, but I finally made my first trip to Wichita, and as anybody knows who's walked through the airport, it welcomes you to the flight capital of the world.
Yeah, for sure. And let's see, didn't you have an opportunity to talk with some of the folks at Cessna?
Yeah, I spent the day at Cessna, and it was a very interesting visit. For the most part, I'm doing a story for Wired magazine about fast jets. And as I'm sure many listeners know, the fastest civilian jet currently made in the world is the Citation 10 business jet, which held the title for many years. And then Gulfstream came along and stole the title of the fastest jet for a little while, and then Cessna came back and reclaimed it. Now, granted, we're splitting hairs here. I think the difference was Mach 0.92 versus Mach 0.925, which works out to be just a handful of miles per hour. But let's face it, as Don Draper proves week in and week out, marketing matters, so they wanted to get that title back.
Yeah, for sure. Rob, how does that stack up against your favorite, the Falcon 7X?
Falcon 7X is not near as fast as 0.925. My brain is working here. I believe it's about a 0.86 airplane.
Pokey.
Perhaps 8.7. I don't think it's any faster than that. But of course, the not being the math guy like Max, what's the difference between 0.86 speed of sound and 0.92 in terms of miles an hour? Yeah. Can you do that in your head?
No, not at this time of night. But
as Jason said, it's bragging rights, and there is something to be said for that when you're trying to build business jets.
Yeah.
It was interesting because they gave me the opportunity to go on a demo flight in one of the flight test airplanes, and the prototype is still busy making flights. I have to say, one of the interesting things, I got to walk inside the prototype of the new Citation 10. And, part of me just really thinks that flight test aircraft are so much cooler on the inside than the end product. I mean, who needs leather and fancy wood when you can have, computers and raw aluminum and all that kind of stuff? It looks so much more interesting inside. And one of the more interesting appointments, shall we say, on the prototype was a large, probably about a 1.5-inch rope with knots tied in about every 10 inches or so that was firmly attached to the ceiling from the cockpit between the pilots all the way back to an escape hatch, which was in the middle of the cabin. Huh. And of course, that's not something you see on very many option lists for a luxury business jet. But it was, you know, in the case of emergency and the aircraft is tumbling, you need something to be able to hold on to. And so the pilots can just go hand over hand on this giant piece of rope and find their way to the back of the airplane.
Wow.
That was a pretty cool feature. But anyways, I went on one of the newer flight test aircraft that's being used for some software adjustments and other things. And of course, you know, the test pilot wanted to show what the airplane was capable of. So we did a head snapping takeoff roll, where I wasn't paying attention and my head actually did snap back and hit the seat. And then he proceeded to climb out at, I think he said, about 25 degrees nose up pitch angle, which for anybody who flies knows that's a fairly steep climb out, which was entertaining, shall we say, to say the least.
Oh, sounds like a great flight. All right. Yeah. Wichita is an interesting place. It's a great destination actually for aviation geeks. They also have some great steaks there. I've had some of the best steaks of my life in Wichita.
Yeah, the Scotch and Sirloin east of the airport there is pretty good.
Yeah, there's a couple of great steak places out there.
See, I should have called you guys beforehand. You guys could have given me all the tips. I did go on a run one morning. I was only there for 2 days, and I went on a run, and it's definitely kind of cool to just run around the airport and see, you know, the history that's there and the current aircraft companies that are there. There's definitely a lot to see in Wichita.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Jason, this has been great. Tell us where folks can find you online. Where do you hang out mostly, besides the Wired articles and so forth? You're on Twitter.
I am on Twitter. It's pretty creative, my Twitter handle. It's JasonPaur, which is better known as my name.
It works.
And I'm a little bit embarrassed that... that is pretty much the extent of my presence. I am not the most, shall we say, active person when it comes to trying out all sorts of different things.
Yeah, but that's because you're spending all your time writing great content for Wired, right? You don't have...
Well, thank you very much.
I don't have time for this stuff.
That's a good excuse, isn't it? That's a good excuse. I'll take it.
That's the one I'd go with for sure.
Okay.
And I want to be there for the first airplane with no pilot in it so that I can wave... goodbye to Jason.
and you.
Anyway, how did I get volunteered for the first one?
Yeah, I'm not sure I want the first one.
Because Max doesn't want to go by himself.
That's right. If I'm going to buy the big one. All right, Jason, thanks so much for joining us. We'll have to have you on again. Hopefully it won't be so long next time. And we look forward to following your other article. I'm sure you're going to have some more stories about the Solar Impulse as it progresses across the country.
We'll definitely have some more stories about the Solar Impulse. And matter of fact, we've got some interesting things coming up about some other electric aircraft, including one that's out there to break records. And I will tease you with the idea that maybe next time we can talk about the first mid-air refueling of an electric airplane, which, of course, just means transferring electrons.
Ooh, that's
for another day.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks.
David has left the building.
Yes, he has, Rob. David needs to attend to other things. And so, as we mentioned at the start, no history segment this week, but David will be back next week.
Is he in the men's room?
Yeah, I'm not sure where. You know, I think he's probably sound asleep in his bed.
Oh, okay.
But you know who's not sound asleep in their beds? That's the Australians, because they're kind of out of phase with us. And we have
what an interesting way to put that.
Yes.
Steve and Grant, talk your way out of that.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 20th of May, 2013, and welcome to the Accent Desk.
Yes, the accent desk for episode 249. What do you mean that you can't say 13 properly, Grant? What was Rob talking about last week?
I don't know. 2013.
2013. I can't help it if he doesn't speak Her Majesty's Australian New Zealand version of English, sort of, kind of.
Yeah, mate, I think we've really got to work on his accent. It sounds pretty odd, you know.
Let's talk about a local manufacturer down here who we've spoken about in the past, and that's Gipps Aero. Now, a great company, we've spoken highly of them in the past, and yes, they've sponsored us here in the past, but some interesting news. I don't know that it's been well received, and quite a confusing press release that's come out this week, Grant. What's going on down there?
Well, they've announced that they're actually going to restructure their business and furlough 40 personnel. But at the same time, they're saying they're reducing the number of employees to take full advantage of the exciting opportunities which face the general aviation industry. Mate, to me, that sounds a lot like what happened when the federal government said they were stopping work on the Badgerys Creek Airport development in order to fast track it.
It's just spin doctoring there. I've read that press release through a few times, and I can't make any sense of it. It's basically trying to make the fact that they're sacking people sound good. Now, you know, there's been a lot of commentary going around this week about what they might be doing. We must remember, of course, that Gipps Aero's parent company is Mahindra Aerospace, and that's an Indian company. And I guess the worry down in the Latrobe Valley where this company is based is that, you know, and this is only pure speculation, but they may be looking at changing some of the roles slightly and then bringing in workers from India to take over these roles. Now, we don't know that that's happening, but if that speculation proved to be true, that would be monstrously unpopular and pretty damn unfair on the workers down in that area. That's a very, very working class area down there, and they can use the jobs.
Indeed. There's also speculation that they may be getting ready to start doing manufacturing in India, not in Australia anymore. A lot cheaper to build things over there, take the knowledge and experience from here and work with it over there. As usual, these kind of announcements are opening up more questions than ever before, and a lot of us are all sitting here going, huh? And it's a shame because the GA8 air van is a big success. The GA10 turboprop is just starting to kick in, and you know, there's the GA18 Nomad rebuild, which now some people are starting to say, oh, I guess that means the Nomad's not going to happen. But honestly, I think it's a little too early to really say. It's taking a lot of people by surprise, especially after the grants from the local council for various developments. There's been tarmac work done. State governments put money in there. So not quite the direction we'd like to see it going, especially if a lot of these people who are furloughed may turn around and get other work elsewhere. And then when Mahindra turns around and says, okay, time to ramp things back up with Gipps Aero, these people won't be available. And the cynics in the world out there have been commenting that this means that, of course, they're probably hoping on that because that's their leverage to bring in some foreign workers on 457 visas. So I don't know. There's a lot of scuttlebutt, of course, as you'd expect with this kind of announcement. I guess we'll just keep an eye on it and see what the next few months bring.
And of course, Gipps Aero, a very successful brand here, and Americans who have anything to do with the Civil Air Patrol over there would know that they also build aircraft for that organization. So we certainly hope that it's good news. We'll keep following this one. It's obviously close to our hearts. It's we've had a bit of an association, as I mentioned, with that company. And, I hope things are, not going downhill for them. That would be most disappointing. Now, Grant, moving on and talking about things that are going downhill, Virgin Australia's profits are going downhill at the moment. That's probably not surprising, given the way they've been spending money lately, buying other airlines and everything.
Yeah, there's also been, they changed over to the Sabre booking management and airline management system. And as part of that, they cut about 15% of their flights so that there was some slack in their schedules to allow for the problems of changing system, people coming up to speed, and the inevitable issues that arise when things go into production. Now, they did indicate that probably cost them about $50 million of people going across to Qantas to get the flights they wanted. They expected they were going to be able to remake that later in the year. And unfortunately, things have not really kept going the way they were at the start of this year, where they were looking pretty good and everything was going quite well. Well, things have calmed down a little since January. It's got a little quieter. A lot of the prosperity from the mining boom and so on seems to have come off the boil. So they haven't been able to make back that $50 million. They've also had a bit of an issue related to the fare war that's going on with Qantas. And we've been waiting for the shoe to drop. Both airlines have been quite busy putting on lots more capacity, but slashing prices to fill it. So that's been hurting them a bit as well. Now, they're still going to make a profit, they reckon, by the end of the year, but they have had to announce that it's going to be a lot less than previously expected. Now, this is Virgin. They've done that. Of course, their investors have turned around and said, nah, and they've sold down the stock, which is kind of to be expected. Etihad has purchased more of the stock. They got about another 1% thanks to what was going on. But of interest is, as we reported last week, where Alan Joyce sort of hinted that they may be in the same environment, they may have the same issues, but they haven't come clean and announced it as yet. So whether Qantas are holding off to the bitter end to say, oh yeah, we couldn't make the same profit, we'll see.
We'll see. In fact, according to some statistics here that Virgin released, they're saying that domestic revenue load factors are down 5.6% this year, and passenger numbers falling 5% compared to the same month last year. So 5%, it's not really a big number, I suppose, but it just goes to highlight, Grant, just what a knife edge these operations run on when it comes to making profits. It's obviously something that they've really got to keep an eye on. Now, Grant, speaking of airlines that Virgin own, Tiger Airways has come out this week and Woo-hoo! Said that it lost 69 million Singaporean dollars. That's 56.5 million Australian dollars in 2012-2013. And, I guess they'll be hoping that the recent huge investment by Virgin Australia into that airline might help to pull them out of that rut.
Well, they're definitely seeing an increase in the utilization of their aircraft. They were, of course, grounded by CASA, and then they were severely restricted on what they could do when they came back. So their utilization has not been up to the level that it should be for a low-cost carrier, really working the heck out of those airframes. That's now changing. They've got a bit more free rein. They're coming back into the full speed ahead with those aircraft, and I think we're going to see some improvements on returns. I'm not going to turn around and say they're going to make a profit, but I would say that in the next few months and quarters, we should start seeing some better conditions coming along for them.
So there we go. That wraps up the aviation news here this week. Grant, I think you just had a quick mention of some feedback from last week's episode.
That's right, mate. Thanks to Micah for his recorded comment regarding my take on McDonnell Douglas. He is correct. I certainly wasn't having a go at the aircraft. I agree with himself and also David. The McDonnell Douglas aircraft were fantastic. Love the Phantom, the DC-9, MD, etc. Love the DC-10, but unfortunately, it was just a company that was mismanaged down to the end, and Micah did highlight one of the aspects that they got a little crazy with. That was more my factor. It was not the aircraft. When the engineers were running it, it was great. But once those management guys got a little bit carried away with themselves, in my eyes, the company went downhill very quickly, and thus the buyout by Boeing, which, it was kind of funny because the joke is that Boeing thought they were buying McDonnell Douglas, but really McDonnell Douglas allowed themselves to be bought by Boeing. But I don't know how you want to take that one, mate. But anyhow, thanks to Micah for his comments. He was pretty much right on about where I was coming from. It was not the aircraft, but the management that annoyed me about that once great company.
Yes, and listeners might know in the background that Grant has offered quite a few rather lengthy rants via email lately about that subject. He's quite passionate about it, aren't you, mate?
Yeah, I just feel it's the same things that I feel about Qantas and Boeing and a number of other companies that I see management making what I believe to be the wrong decisions, and a lot of problems coming out of that. And yeah, I'm an opinionated enthusiast, and I'm willing to voice my opinions.
Fair enough. Well, I'll tell you what, Grant, I'm going to make a right decision right now. I'm going to go and have lunch before I do this editing.
Well, that sounds like a really good idea, mate. And it's really weird. It's midday, not midnight. What are we doing recording at midday?
Yeah, I know. It's great. Well, I convinced you to stay home from work today, and I should do this more often.
Yeah, my wallet says no.
Absolutely. Well, until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, folks.
As always, we thank Steve and Grant for that great Australia Desk report. Let's move on now to Peter Johnson across the pond. I think he's going to be talking about flight training in the UK. Here's Peter.
Today, I'm in the beautiful English countryside at Cotswold Airfield, and I'm joined by Dave Jelly from Freedom Aviation. Dave, welcome to Across the Pond.
Hi, nice to meet you today. We're basically a small training company at Cotswold Kemble Airport in Wiltshire, and we've been running for about 5 or 6 years. We also operate from another local grass strip airfield called Oaksey Park, which is 3 miles to the south.
Okay.
It's got a 1,000-meter runway, and this has got about 2,500 meters. This is an ex-military airfield, and so it's got fantastic facilities.
Oh, so tell me a little bit about where's the term freedom come from in your company's name, and what's that really mean?
I've been in the military for the last 24 years. I'm just leaving at the moment, right. And we wanted to have airborne aviation because of my Korea has been predominantly in the air and dealing with parachuting and all the rest of it. But airborne aviation had already been taken.
Right.
And we really canvassed lots and lots of people say, what can we call our company? And it was about what we want to give to our customer, really.
Yeah.
And so the freedom is the whole freedom of flight.
Right,
okay. And you know, letting people enjoy the freedom of flying.
Right, okay. And what sort of services does Freedom Aviation deliver?
Well, we're a PPL training company, and we lease light aircraft to other flying clubs. But we're slightly different in the sense that we try and tailor our training to what the customer wants. So we're not not necessarily focused on like a 1 hour lesson, come in the door, brief, fly, and get out the door. People come to us for a day, 3 days, a week, or maybe an evening or an early morning. And we try and focus our training on people who want to achieve recreational flying. So we tend to take people to other parts of the country, certainly into Wales and Scotland, and so some adventure flying.
Right, okay. And I'm familiar with trainee pilots jetting off to the USA. I'm one of those, actually. I did that a decade or so ago, and other places to fly and build hours. But what makes it different flying in this part of the world?
I suppose I can answer that simply and say the weather, which is usually somewhere between average and atrocious. And really, I've worked with lots of people who have trained all over the world. And in fact, America do probably provide some of the world's best pilot training. But the difference over here is the terrain, the country, the airspace over here is much more congested. And it really needs the training focusing on where people can and can't fly and what are the limitations of where they can go. And really, again, it is the weather. You know, it can be very difficult and it can be very changeable in a short period of time.
So are you looking then to give people, in effect, real life experience in their flying training rather than possibly some artificial environments that you can get in other parts of the world?
Yeah, for sure. Although it's not always convenient, we have been stuck at airfields for, you know, a day, 2 days.
Yeah.
We have been stuck in Scotland for 3 or 4 days. And although that's not always fantastic, you know, you do get a nice night out somewhere else. And you do get to spend time, you know, studying the weather and looking at how, you know, the best route, you know, how we are going to get back to where we started from. So
now, the airfield we're at, I want to call it an airport. I mean, there's some heavy stuff out here. There's some 747s, Airbuses, 737s, and there are some other businesses on the airfield here. Does that create real challenges in terms of any air traffic issues for your students?
Actually, the air traffic control here is very good and it's very high quality. And what you find is that as an instructor, you build up the knowledge of who else is doing what around the area, who's likely to be flying, where they're coming from, where they're going to. And with the assistance of the airfield and the air traffic control here, everybody slots in rather well. Now, for students, although it's hard to begin with, what it means is that when they've completed, by the time they've completed their training, they are familiar with a busy multi-operational environment. So it gives them that, you know, I know some people have trained from very, you know, remote grass strip type airfields, but this gives them a balance. But it still does have a grass, there is still a grass runway here. So people can use that, you know, if that's the type of flying they're going to pursue.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about some of your aircraft and the specifications they have, so some of our listeners can understand the capabilities of what you can deliver.
Well, generally, we operate Piper Warriors like a lot of training schools. The only you know, the difference I would say is we have a constant program of improvement. In fact, we're sitting looking at one of our aircraft that came out of the paint shop last week.
Yeah, it's looking very nice.
And we are, you know, we're just about to move into the whole Garmin avionics suites for all of the aircraft. They've all had new engines within the last 24 months. And so we're on a constant cycle of improvement. About to progress with having leather interiors fitted, and so we're trying to offer high end aircraft, you know, at the fairest price we can.
Okay. And what about your flying background and your flying experience? You mentioned the military there. What's your experience to have got you to this point, I suppose, that you can be a CFI and pass that on? What's your background?
Well, my background, although I've spent my working life, my military career, in an aircraft, I've actually been in the back of a C-130 Hercules, parachuting heavy stores and equipment to soldiers and people on the ground. So, although I've spent time on the flight deck of a C-130, thousands of hours, it's not been, you know, controlling the aircraft.
Yeah,
that's something I always wanted to do. So, I started pursuing my private pilot's license about 12 years ago.
Okay.
Within 6 months, I was completely addicted. I knew at that point I wanted to become a flying instructor, and I wanted to fly all over Europe and all over the world, really. So I progressed my flying, and once I'd reached 300 hours, I got a class rating instructor rating, which is like a mini instructor rating. From there, I took a year's career break from the military, went to Oxford to do my airline pilot's license.
Right, okay.
That was probably 5 or 6 years ago. And since then, my last 2 or 3 years in the military, I've been flying parachute jump airplanes at a military parachute centre.
Yep.
So Cessna Caravans and the like.
Yep.
And from here, really, I want to progress just into the whole sport flying, the recreational flying, and taking people to remote places, places that are very difficult to access, and enjoying the rewards that flying gives.
Right. Well, it's a lovely part of the world, and we wish you every success. Thanks for having us here.
And thank you very much for having me, and hopefully I'll speak to you again. Cheers.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Okay, thanks, Peter.
I always like that when I get to listen to somebody that spent as much time as he did in the back of an airplane say, nope, I haven't had enough. I want to do more.
Yeah, right, right.
It is pretty hard to get this out of your blood once it's in.
Once it's in, for sure.
It's kind of like being a vampire. Once you're bitten, you're stuck.
You're hooked. There's no way out. Yeah, you know. That's a great thing. That's fantastic. Rob, where did you get your flight instruction? Did you get that in the Air Force or elsewhere? I can't remember.
Actually, I started flying down at University of Illinois in Champaign, but since I quit after my first semester and ran off to join the Air Force, I didn't finish my stuff until I got out of the Air Force, because you couldn't fly in the Air Force unless you were an officer, which you couldn't be unless you had a degree, which... Mm. Like a dope, I didn't know that, and so, but actually, it was still a lot of fun because my my GI Bill, which was pretty robust in those days, helped pay for an awful lot of the training. So, I think I was well rewarded for my 5 years in the Air Force.
For your service, yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right, great. Well, listen, let's move on to some listener mail. We'll start out with a voicemail from Patrick. Here's what Patrick sent us.
Hi, geeks. Patrick Wiggins here in Utah. Hey, first, as a relatively new listener, I'd like to ask, just who is that Anta Benet, I think that's how you say it, that always gives out the number for the listener line? I don't think I've heard her anywhere else in the show. But as to the subject at hand, the last couple of episodes, you've had comments about why people would jump out of perfectly good airplanes. Well, as someone who's been jumping and flying since the 60s, and whose mother started jumping before I did, I've heard untold numbers of people ask that very same question. Well, the answer? No, I look them straight in the eye, and with a straight face, I reply, because they opened the door. Thanks, guys. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Oh, that's a great response to that question.
Oh, I thought he was going to say because they pushed me out.
Oh, no.
And it's Antibonite, as in A-U-N-T-I-E, or Antibonite,
depending on where you're from.
On the East Coast.
Yes.
Back where you guys are, but Antibonite. And what is he? She's a social media geek-ess at the Aircraft Owner and Pilots Association.
Yeah, that's where she is now. You know, the fact that, our new listener, Patrick, and,
yeah,
and others
forget about that, I guess,
don't know. Worry. You know, that, you know what that tells us, Rob? That tells us we haven't had Binet on in an awful long time.
Who? But,
oh, yes. But, yeah, we first...
Good point. You're right.
Yeah, we need to get her back on. But
I'll give her a jingle tomorrow.
Well, we're gonna see her at Become a Pilot Day at the Air and Space Museum, right? Isn't she going to attend?
Well, that's right. So I won't give her a jingle.
So we'll see her there. And so for the new listeners, yeah, we first kind of ran into Binet when she was an editor at Aviation Week and appeared on the show a number of times. And as Rob mentioned, she moved on to the AOPA. Where she does some great work there. And we just love Aunt Binet to death. She's just a wonderful person.
Well, but you know, maybe this is a good time to mention to people what's coming up on June 15th.
Ah, that's right. Go ahead, Rob.
June 15th is the day that we will all be running the show. That's the Airplane Geek Show.
Yes.
We'll be running the Airplane Geek Show from the floor of the Air and Space Museum's Udvar Hazy Pavilion at Dulles International Airport in Washington as the guest of the Air and Space
Museum.
People.
You're right. Along with some others. We're not the only guests.
Oh, my Lord. See, no. I'm bad without a script. I'm not a good ad-libber. Anyway, so we'll go on. And so we think we might be close to the same table that the Aircraft Owner and Pilots Association folks are going to be, but that's not confirmed yet. But so if you're a loyal listener in the Washington, D.C. area, or a loyal listener in some other part of the world, fly in, and the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, especially Aunt Binet, said she will pay for it. And just send her the bill flight, and I would go first class if it was me. And,
oh, no, you're in trouble, Rob.
Join us that day at the Airplane Geek Show, and I think we usually get started, what, maybe 10 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, around 10 o'clock. Yes. So this is a great event. They've held this for several years now, and there's all kinds of activities.
Well, I don't think I mentioned that it's the Learn to Fly Day.
Right. Yes, right.
Become a Pilot Day.
And so right. Besides being able to see all of the exhibits that are always at the museum, there are a number of sort of specially invited guests like ourselves and some others that will be doing some things, having some activities. But they also have a huge number of aircraft fly in, aircraft of all sorts. Now, last year, there were a lot of military aircraft amongst them. I don't know if we're going to see that this year or not. I don't know. Have you heard, Rob, if we're going to...
Well, certainly some of the military may be cut. But honestly, if you saw nothing outside and you only spent the day inside...
More than enough.
I still remember last year when Discovery had just shown up and David took us on that tour and he knew the numbers on the tiles. And
yeah, David's incredible.
What the material was and how hot it was baked. I mean, I was just unbelievable. But there are so many things to see inside the Air and Space Museum that certainly there will be, learn to fly events. But again, I mean, there's going to be so much action happening on the floor, not to mention
outside
the Airplane Geeks table.
Oh, well, there too. Yeah. So
yeah.
Bring your kids if you've got them. If you don't have them, heck, bring someone else's kids. I mean,
that's why we're going to try and bring Dan Webbage. Who knows?
Yeah.
We'll try.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be fantastic. But yeah, so it's a great great experience for kids, and it's not limited to that. There's plenty to do and to see for adults. So I hope to see a good turnout again this year, June 15th. Also, the Twitter hashtag is Pilot Day 13. And there's already a little bit of action, a few tweets out there on that. So set up
We better do that right now as soon as we finish tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Pilot Day 13, follow it there. And, you know, especially as the event approaches, and in fact, during the event, there'll be a lot of action there. And that'd be a good place to find out where we are, what we're doing, maybe even more importantly, what we're doing after the event. And maybe we can all have a bit of a meetup.
And it will give people a chance to realize that I'm not near as old as everybody makes out to be.
I may even get a haircut by then.
Probably not.
You know that picture of me from last year?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, imagine that picture with the hair about 8 inches longer than that.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, I hope everybody shows up.
And there's another story behind that. But
we'll see some of our regular guys there. And gals, of course. I'm sorry.
Okay, let's plow ahead quickly with some of the other email that we got. Ian wrote us saying, just finished listening to the episode where you were talking about Speedos, something that I regret entirely. He says, in New Zealand, they are also known as budgie smugglers.
Budgie smugglers?
Yeah, he says, I think that may be an Australian saying. Yeah, do you think?
Crikey. Do you know what a budgie is?
I don't want to know what a budgie is.
Well, if it's the same thing it is in Britain, it's a little bird. A budgie is what we call a parakeet.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure if that's what it means here or not. We got to get out that Australian dictionary again.
Is that a budgie in your pocket, or are you happy to see?
No. Okay. So Ian also says, just booked my flight to Oshkosh this year. Hey. He says, I am taking my father, who was the last. Now, get this. He's taking his father, who was the last ever chief flight engineer for Air New Zealand. Outside North America, he says, flight engineers were not pilots and were generally originally trained as licensed aircraft engineers. He says he's flown the Electra, the DC-8, DC-10, 747-200, and has done the course for the 767, 747-400, and he says was involved in their entry into service. He has some amazing stories. So I think that's so cool. Yeah, that'd be great. Bring your dad. That's great. He says, anyway, we are very excited about going to Oshkosh and are going to be there for 5 days. That's great. He says, we are then going to Dayton to the U.S. Air Force Museum, which will be great. Greetings from New Zealand. So, yeah, what a great trip. I mean, between Oshkosh and the Air Force Museum in Dayton, I mean, those are obviously must-see kind of destinations. So, good job, Ian. You're going to have a great trip, I know.
Can we mention the guy up in John up in Vancouver? I think you saw that note, didn't I?
Yeah, go ahead.
The float plane guy?
Yes, this is in Vancouver. Yes, right.
Oh, so are you going to do it or do you want me to do it?
No, I think you should do it because I don't know what it is really.
Well, I was going to say, I've got a really cool picture today from a young man who goes by the name of John, and we'll only use his first name because I don't want to embarrass him up there in the beautiful Vancouver Harbor area. But he sent me a really great photo that I posted up on Twitter and Facebook and all that today about the sunrise over the harbor. But John reminded me that one of the most important elements of networking is to tell other people about cool things that you're doing. And he mentioned his On the Step blog, which is about basically float planes, being a float plane geek. And so I told John I would give him a mention, even though he specifically asked me not to. But I'm doing it anyway because I think float planes are really cool.
They are cool. So
it's on-the-step.com, onthestep.com. And it's some really cool float plane stuff in it. So way to go, John. And wasn't that nice the way I didn't mention your name so nobody can find you at least easily when they get to Vancouver Harbor?
Oh, wow. I'm bringing this up now. You know, when you sent that, Rob, today, I was at work. And so I didn't really see that. I couldn't click on the link at the time. I mean, I wasn't able to. But I am now.
Have you ever been up to Vancouver?
Briefly, yes. I love Vancouver.
Oh, it is a cool. I mean, I don't know about the rest of the town, but who cares about the rest of the town? I just thought the harbor was really cool. So,
yeah. Well, I'm looking at these float plane pictures he's got on his site here. These are really nice. These are pretty impressive. There's just something cool about float planes. I like float planes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen. Hey, we have one another voicemail we received. I think this is from Mac, but I'm not sure because it was kind of hard for me to hear. But this is about ADS-B. So, Rob, listen to this.
Hello, geeks. This is Mac the Fly from Jacksonville. I am a part owner in a PA-32 Cherokee 6, and we're looking at the upcoming technological changes required for our aircraft. And the reader in 244, or the listener in 244, asked the question about the ADS-B out. And one of our decision issues is upgrading our transceiver audio to take not only the mode S or mode C, but also mode S and ADS-B out. So we're looking at a new Garmin transceiver for that reason to get that added to the plane. So being able to receive ADS-B in is one issue, having the equipment, but also getting the appropriate ADS-B out equipment is a cost decision that could be as much as $5,000 in a GA aircraft. So I hope that helps. I don't know if it is a major question, but thought I'd help it. Bye-bye.
No, it's expensive to install that, isn't it, Rob?
Well, yeah, and right now most people are just kind of worried about, not worried, but they're thinking about ADS-B in, because you know, we have an ADS-B antenna on the Sky Arrow, the little two-placer that we fly at the club, and it has a Bluetooth connection, and if I sit in the back with one of the apps like AOPA's mapping app or some other one for flight, I can get ADS-B traffic displayed on the iPad. And so there's already quite a bit of information that you can get for free if you have ADS-B in, at least. And the ADS-B out, I wouldn't buy it yet, guys. I don't think it's ready for prime time yet because it's not going to be required, I believe, until 2020. So there's an awful lot of change that can happen in the next 7 years. But that's going to be the part that tells all the airplanes where everybody else is. And, but again, I think it might be a little early for that, but that's just me.
All right. Well, you know, you can be an early adopter or you can sit back and wait till it matures. And
yeah, I know. That's like that nobody in the front seat flying the airplane stuff, Max. I'll be there to wave goodbye when you go.
All right. Okay. last couple of items from, we got some emails from, one from Ray Bonita and one from Brian Carlson, kind of related. And recently we saw an American Airlines pilot who made an emergency landing because a passenger would not stop singing Whitney Houston's song, "I Will Always Love You." And there's a little bit of video out there. I think that all the passengers, of course, were, you know, watching this little solo performance and trying to capture this because it was kind of ridiculous. I don't know if you saw this, Rob, but if it had been Whitney Houston singing that, or someone who could sing at least half as well as Whitney Houston was able to, I think maybe people would have enjoyed it. But that really wasn't the case.
She could probably do a better job in her current state than this guy did in his current state. But I think the guy had just kind of had a bit too much high altitude with not enough oxygen, maybe. who knows?
You know, interestingly enough, when you watch one of the videos, you can hear the flight attendants admonishing passengers to stop taking pictures. But recently, we also saw where a passenger ran into a certain amount of trouble because they were taking pictures on the flight, and the airline says that, well, the attendant said that, well, you know, it's against policy. You're not allowed to take pictures of people or the plane or whatever. So I guess Rob, what are you going to do on a flight if you can't sing and you can't take pictures of your friends? You know,
you can't take pictures. I would defy someone to show me where it says that. because I, unless that's in the fine print when you buy an airline ticket, I mean, but any, you're right. What's left? I mean, there's just no fun on the airplanes anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it is in the fine print because in Brian's email, there's a quote. Apparently, it's an official rule at American Airlines. And here's what it says. It says, the use of still and video cameras, film or digital, is permitted only for recording of personal events, unauthorized photography or video recording of airline personnel, other customers, aircraft equipment, which is, what, the whole inside of the plane, or procedures is strictly prohibited. And he says, other airlines have similar policies. United Airlines recently kicked a travel blogger off an international flight for camera use. And I think I recall seeing that one as well. So,
wow. I guess I stand corrected.
I suppose the lesson is, it doesn't matter if it's a rule or not, but if the flight attendants start telling you to stop doing something, I think you ought to stop doing it, because if you don't...
Yeah, that's probably a good point.
Yeah, you're going to... Yeah, you end up with a diverted flight, and you've got some explaining to do, as they say. All right, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This has been episode 249. Next time is the big 250. And we want to thank everyone for listening to us, especially our new listeners. I hope we've lived up to some of your expectations. We want to especially thank our guests.
Or down to them.
Or down to them. Yeah. I did see you. Well, we want to thank our guest, Jason Parr. Jason, you can find Jason at Wired. You know, Wired has some, I don't know, they like sections on the site. There's Autopia and the Danger Room and Wired Science, and you can find Jason frequently in all of those. We'll put some links in the show notes, and we'll put links in the show notes to all the articles that Jason has written about the solar impulse. It's really fascinating stuff. It's worth taking a look at. And you can follow Jason on Twitter as Jason Parr, JasonPaur. All right. We also want to thank our contributors, Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron. You can find them at plaincrazydownunder.com for their great podcast. Give that a listen. Also, Peter Johnson, you can find his podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. And let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, since I'm the only one left, yeah. Hey, jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, Jetwine and Robert, I think it's Robert P. Mark on Facebook. I don't know. I never look myself up on Facebook.
Yeah. Well, you can.
And then search on LinkedIn. Are you on LinkedIn? I think we started to talk about that last
Yeah, we
time.
Did start to talk about it. And I regret talking about it because.
Because you're not on LinkedIn.
No, I am on LinkedIn. But I'll tell folks this, is that unlike Twitter and Facebook and other places where I'll friend to just about anybody, I don't do that on LinkedIn. If I don't know you personally, I'm not going to connect with you. I keep that strictly for relationships that are, you know, of a personal or, you know, business professional nature. So
that's why you've been refusing my invites. I've got you.
Okay. Yeah, right to the bit bucket.
Hey, and we could say we're also, one of us is also David Vanderhoof, and you could find him on What Just Flew Blah. Okay.
It's a mouthful.
You better say it, Max. I don't think I can.
I can only say it slowly. What Just Flew By. .com. And he's also on Twitter as DM Vanderhoof. All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter also as Max Flight. Also on Google Plus and at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode. Again, this is 249 at airplanegeeks.com. And we'll have lots of links to the sites that we mention on the podcast. And be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. We have a Google Plus community as well. And just look for Airplane Geeks for all of those. And we're also on Stitcher.com. And a very interesting site. They have a lot of interesting content there. You can stream us right to your mobile phone at Stitcher.com.
Did you say people can scream at us?
They can scream at us. That's at the geeks at AirplaneGeeks.com. But they can stream us on Stitcher and scream us at the geeks at AirplaneGeeks.com.
I guess.
And of course, as we mentioned, we have a listener line where you can leave us a 2 or 3 minute voice message. If you go longer than that, it cuts you off, so you have to be kind of brief. We encourage people to do that. If you know, you make a recording and you say, "Ah, geez, I sounded lousy," just do it again, and we'll just throw away the old one or put it in the outtakes. No, we'll throw away the old one. Or if you want to send us an MP3 recording that you make, that's fine too. But if you want to call our listener line, Aunt Benet has that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thanks, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thanks for listening. So while we're waiting, David, what did you think?
I told you, I'm still recovering. My mind is blown.
I can't believe, and the guy that they chose, I mean, he's a great actor, but I'm shocked.
You're just going to have to spend 6 months like the rest of us suffering.
What are you guys talking about?
What happens in 6 months? Oh, you mean waiting for the next episode?
Yes.
Yeah.
What show is this?
Doctor Who.
They should have known better. Doctors on
this. No, Matt is already here. If this will make you feel better, Matt is signed up for season 8. They made that announcement the other day.
Oh, I didn't hear. So you knew something was coming the other night then?
Well, no. They made the announcement after the show went on. But
oh, I see. I didn't see.
No,
that.
I didn't know about John Hurt being the man who did things under somebody else's name.
What?
Well, that he was he's not the doctor. He didn't do so.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
And, I used to watch that show in the 70s.
Well,
how many Doctor Who's have there been since then?
Still just as good.
We're up to number 11, but it is the 50th anniversary of the television show.
You're kidding. 50?
Yeah.
Gee, wow.
And
I started watching it in England when I was back there in the late 60s.
Hmm. Incredible.
And last night was Saturday night was probably one of the greatest episodes of all time.
Can I ask a drone dummy question?
Of course, okay. Rob. We've been waiting for it.
Can we give drone dummy answers?
Up with? Jason, you see what I have to put up with? I mean... they don't take. Oh, it's just unbelievable.
Is there a question there?
No, seriously. Yeah, there's a question here. I'm getting to it.
Okay.
I'm getting to it. Okay.
Okay, Rob, are you?
I'm on, baby.
You got the recording going again?
I'm recording, baby. I'm on autopilot.
All right. Yeah, good. Stay that way, all right?
Oh my God, we're gonna die!
Okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1, wait for the car to go past. 4, 5.
It is episode 249, isn't it?
Yes.
Got it.
Are we ever going to start?
3, 2, 1.
Dateline, 20th of May, 2013, and welcome to the Accent Death.
Now listen here, Rob Mark, who's the voiceover guy? Well, actually, he's not Grant.
The battle of the voiceovers.
The battle of the voiceovers.
Well, June 15th, let's see, June 15th,
That's Saturday.
Oh, right, right. No, June 15th is the day that we will be, should I say, performing the airplane. Okay, let me just start this whole thing over again, Max.
Okay.
No, it's not explain it. It's just splainin'.
Splainin' to do.
Because Ricky couldn't say explain. He just explained. Right. Of course, they don't even know what we're talking about, so.
No, the youngsters don't.
Save that for another day.
Okay.